Mr. Magruder, you told a Harvard seminar that President Nixon took part in decision-making at the committee to re-elect the president until a month after the Watergate. So I guess I have to ask you Senator Howard Baker's question. What do you think the president knew, and when did he know it, about the Watergate burglary?
It's been my feeling that he did not have any direct knowledge of the plans to break into the Watergate, that he was interested, as were most of the people in the positions of authority at the White House, in intelligence gathering. But I did not think, I don't think now, that he knew of any specific plans to make an entry into the Watergate complex at the Democratic National Committee.
Until
after the break-in. The day after the break-in, I'm sure. I talked with Bob Haldeman on Sunday, and he was at Key Biscayne with the president, so I'm sure on that Sunday he became aware of the involvement of the committee to re-elect in the break-in.
From CBS News, Washington. A spontaneous and unrehearsed news interview on Face the Nation. With Jeb Stuart Magruder, former deputy director of the Nixon Re-Election Committee, who has just been released from prison. Mr. Magruder will be questioned by CBS News correspondent Leslie Stahl, Hayes Gorey of Time Magazine, and CBS News correspondent George Herman. Face the Nation is produced by CBS News, which is solely responsible for the selection of today's guest and panel.
IBM is pleased to sponsor these Face the Nation broadcasts, which give you, the viewer, an opportunity to hear and evaluate varied opinions on the issues of the day.
Pollution you can see in the city, there's a lot more that you can't see. Sulfur dioxide, for example. It's corrosive, dangerous, and invisible. And that's a problem. It's tougher to fight something when you can't see it.
My name is Baxter Armstrong. I'm one of the researchers working on this problem at IBM Laboratories in Palo Alto and here at San Jose, California. My colleagues, Dr. Shea and Dr. Shear, who started this project. What we've done is take a great deal of data about pollution, put it in a computer, and built a mathematical model of an actual urban situation.
How does that invisible sulfur dioxide spread? Now the computer makes it visible.
You input the data for a new plant in the northeast part of the city, and let's see what it does to this heavy industrialized region over here.
What happens when a new smokestack starts up? The effect can be predicted.
Northwest. Okay. I guess what we'd better do now is see what the effect would be over on the other side of the city, because actually that would...
Let's say the wind shifts. Here's what happens.
Okay, that's... Oh, boy. That's the very worst that could happen then, right?
Researchers can record a pollution field for hours or days and study the changes.
Many scientists are now working in air pollution. This is just a small part of the effort. But it provides an important tool to help us understand the real problems and to plan for real solutions.
IBM, helping people find the answers.
Mr. Magruder, first of all, a sort of a technical question. Are you under any restrictions, either from the court or through advice from your lawyers, not to answer any questions in any certain direction or other direction, lest it... disturb you in the future or any other defendants? Are there any inhibitions whatsoever on what you may answer on this program?
No, there isn't. When we were, when the judge signed the order on Wednesday, giving us time served, that technically meant that we were no longer under the jurisdiction to any extent of the courts. We are not on parole. We're not on probation. We are free men in the true sense of the word. We now can wait 3 to 5 years and apply for a full pardon so that the actual felony would be taken from the records. But no, we are not under any restriction. I'm not under any restriction.
Mr. Magruder, you answered Mr. Herman's question saying that you don't think the president knew. But as I recall your testimony, you said you would not run the Liddy plan by Mitchell a third time without some word from the White House as to whether they wanted it or not. And you got this assurance from Gordon Strawn. From whom do you think he got that assurance?
I assumed that he had received that assurance from Bob Haldeman. That had to be his, that was his immediate superior, and it was, of course, my understanding that anything that came from Gordon, who was basically a staff assistant and was not a decision maker in the White House, would that message would have come from Mr. Haldeman.
And would Haldeman have passed that message on without getting one from Mr. Nixon?
I think you'd have to ask Mr. Haldeman that, because I really don't know. I don't really know what the relationship as far as discussion of these type of things between the president and Mr. Haldeman, the former president,
Mr.
Haldeman.
You knew the way the White House operated. Yes. You must have some feelings as to whether Haldeman would do such a thing without. You're not under oath. You're not testifying. No. Now, what is your feeling?
My feeling was that probably at the beginning stages, this was such a minor matter that it was very possibly not discussed with the former president, but certainly the day after the break-in, it became a major subject of discussion.
Well, Mr. Magruder, there was the Houston plan,
yes,
which entailed surveillance, electronic surveillance, and so on. There were other incidents in the White House, which the president surely was acquainted with.
Yes.
So would they not have acquainted him also with this Liddy scheme, which involved much the same?
Well, as I say, I think it is possible, but it is also a situation where there were no fruits from the labor, and it might have been very possible that they were going to wait until something productive came of this plan. I think one of the things that made the wiretapping scheme of Mr. Liddy's acceptable was there had been so much wiretapping in the administration that seemingly another wiretapping situation was acceptable, even though it was illegal.
Do we know about all the wiretapping schemes? In other words, has all the truth come out?
Well, I do not know of any others myself. I was the only one I had any knowledge of. I was not aware, as an example, of the wiretaps on the newsmen and White House staff people under the in 1969 and 1970.
Let me just go back for one last question on the subject we were discussing before, because it was involved in what I said in the opening question, the Harvard seminar that you spoke at. You said there was basically a triad of senior decision makers on the campaign matters: the president, Bob Haldeman, and John Mitchell, until July of 1972. Now, this Liddy plan involved a very large budget. Would not the three senior decision makers have looked at that budget or have talked about it?
In looking at the total campaign budget, it actually was not a large budget. $250,000 in the context of a $60 million campaign was really not a large budget. So it's very possible. We were talking about $6 million direct mail programs that I don't think the president got too involved in, other than the knowledge that we were going to embark on a major direct mail program. So I can see that this was not a major dollar figure for our budgetary purposes.
Mr. Magruder, do you think that the Special Prosecutor's Office should stay in business, should pursue other areas related to Watergate, go after Bebe Rebozo, or do you think that it's time to bury the whole Watergate situation?
Well, I think that if there are any major investigations that are of serious nature, yes, they certainly should complete their work. I think that there is a time when the special prosecutors, and I think Henry Ruth has already indicated that he is not going to extend the grand jury's lives, so the two grand juries that remain, which would indicate to me, and I think correctly so, that there has come a time when the major facts on Watergate have been developed and have come out in testimony. I think the best interests of the country are to move on to more important things, and I think Watergate basically has been discussed, and the facts are out and known.
Well, you keep saying basically. I heard you in an interview earlier this week say that fundamentally all the facts are out.
Well,
the non-fundamentals?
I was only a part of Watergate. I was not involved in much of the other activities that did come out through the investigation, so it's difficult for me as an individual to say that everything is out, because I don't know about everything.
You were in prison with John Dean and with Charles Colson. Did you learn anything or more?
We did not. We were at Fort Halliburton together during the Watergate trial primarily, and we were asked by the special prosecutors, and I think we all agreed that we should not discuss the substantive matters that were before the courts at that time, and we basically did not discuss the Watergate matters to any length at Fort Halliburton.
Mr. Magruder, there have been abuses of power in other administrations, and yet none of the recent ones in any event acquired the degree of taint that the Nixon administration people did. What, in your opinion, was a peculiar or the particular mix which labeled this administration the most scandalous in all history?
Well, I think that the one thing that did happen was that there was no question in my mind. I think it is fair to say that our relationship, particularly with the press, was not a strong one. So when Watergate broke, we basically had no credits to rely on to have the press and other institutions that we had dealt with help us. The Congress is an example. Our relations with the Congress were probably not very strong. So when Watergate broke, we didn't have any credits to go back on. I think possibly in past administrations, if there were activities of any kind that might have the same taint as Watergate, that they may have been able to convince members of the press, members of the Congress, that it was not worth investigating to the extent that Watergate was investigated. I think it was certainly true. I think Fred LaRue said to me one day, you cannot investigate an administration as we were investigated without many things coming out that both were unethical and illegal. And I think, at least certainly in our case, that was true.
You're really not saying that you think the press would treat one administration involved in this kind of activity any differently from another?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that there may not have been quite the incentive to do the kind of digging. I think there was a tremendous amount of ill will which created a desire to go possibly further, even when it looked like there was nothing further to do. And then it turned out there was. If you remember, by October of 1972, Watergate was basically dead. It was an issue that had been discussed for 3 or 4 months, and there was very little factual evidence at that point that any higher-ups other than Mr. Liddy and Mr. Hunt were involved in Watergate. But then there was continual investigation by both members of the press and members of the Congress, which did further, and of the prosecutor's office, which then further uncovered the evidence which basically broke the Watergate case. I think that in many cases there may have been a letdown if there had been more rapport between our administration.
Yeah, but I remember that what you just talked about, the desire to go further, I remember that when it came to a question of going further, and you cite the memo yourself in your book, you are the author of a blueprint of how to attack the media, how to go after media empires through antitrust, how to have the Internal Revenue Service check the income taxes of the, as you say, the three big networks and so forth. And that was the plan that was followed by
the
administration. You wrote the blueprint.
That was in 1969, and that basically was a facetious memo. And I wrote the memo based on the fact that we were being continually, I was working for Herb Klein at the time, and we were continually being bombarded by what I would call very minor matters to go after the networks on what Walter Cronkite might have said last night. And I simply said to them, you know, if you're that concerned about these situations, you should go after it in a different way, because you're just wasting everybody's time and energy. It was really the intent. I was not intending them to go into these matters in that manner.
Did you often write facetious memos to Mr. Haldeman?
I did in that case, and he made it clear, as I remember, that I was not to do that in yeah. further instances. Yeah. And I was a new member of the White House staff at that time, and that was my one effort to say something. I said it, and I was told that was enough.
It appears that they followed what you now call facetious advice. And you now say Haldeman even accepted it as facetious?
Well, at that time, he ignored it and indicated he was not interested, and that we were to continue doing what we were asked to do, which was, in effect, nitpick the networks and so on to accomplish our goals.
You were in prison with, as we mentioned before, John Dean and Charles Colson. Can you tell us, did you detect any changes in them because of the events of the past year?
Well, I think that anyone who goes to prison has to be changed. Someone once said that there are three things that change a person, and it's death, mental illness, or prison. And I think it's basically true. Prison is an extremely discouraging experience for anyone. It is not so much the physical deprivation of the location that you may be situated in, whether it's Allenwood, which is a minimum security prison, or Lewisburg, which is a maximum security prison. It's the fact that your emotional ties that you have grown up with are all of a sudden taken away from you, and you have nothing to put your hands on. Your family is gone. Your friends are gone. Your normal work patterns have been taken away from you. In most prisons, unfortunately, there is no method that even Norman Carlson, the director of Bureau of Prisons, had to basically rehabilitate and work with people. So you move through your day in prison accomplishing very little other than what you yourself have decided you are going to accomplish. So prison has to affect people. It has to affect people in a very negative way. And unfortunately, in our system, people who go to prison can very normally come out as very bitter, hostile people.
Well, you said in your book that Charles Colson was a man with an evil genius. Do you still hold this view?
I truly believe that Chuck has come to Christ, as he has said. I think he is honestly attempting to wrestle with the problems that he had in the past during his White House days, and is truly sincere in his belief.
How has he reacted to the fact that you and Kalmbach and Dean were let out and he wasn't?
Well, I did not see Chuck on Wednesday. He was down at the prosecutor's office, and I left Hollenberg before. I feel very badly personally about Chuck being in prison now, because three of us were released. We were very fortunate. I'm very happy. I've been, to be honest with you, overjoyed in the last few days to be back with my family and back in society again. And I'm sure it's a very discouraging time for Chuck, and I feel very badly personally about it. I think both Gail and I have talked numerous times about his situation now.
Mr. Magruder, some of your friends have quoted you as saying that you think anyone in your circumstances at the committee and in the White House would have done just what you did. Now, I don't know whether that remark is facetious or not, or even if you made it, but do you really believe that?
Well, I think William Raspberry had a column in the Post which struck me as being fairly relevant to this subject just the other day, where he said that most of our young people, even now and in the 50s, certainly in the 60s, have grown up with this tremendous over-competitiveness, and that that in many cases the moral and ethical values that we were taught when we were very young have been overcome by this desire to get ahead. I think in America today, the materialistic values of moving ahead in your corporation, in your business, in your government is very strong. And when you put a lot of very competitive people together, as we had in the White House, as most White House staffs are very competitive, they can engender certain activities where you're, as I said, I think my ethical compass went off center. And I think that's what happened to me. I think that these type of things, obviously, there were some 30 people involved in Watergate. Most of the people, I feel, were basically good people whose ethical compass went off center because of the power, because of the imperial presidency, because of the desire to continually improve their status in the White House.
How do you, Jeb Magruder, protect your children's ethical compass from this grand pressure of the American business competitive scene that you have described?
Well, I hope that we have been very frank with our children about the Watergate episode.
What do you tell them?
Well, we told them early in the Watergate that their father had committed a crime, had made a mistake, and probably would have to go to prison for it. And I think this made it easier for them to understand. They could relate it to mistakes that they had made in their youth, as our oldest is only 14, so they're certainly young children. We were very frank with them, and I think by doing that and by continually communicating with them, and I happen to have a wife who is exceptionally strong and has kept that family together during the time I was gone, and I think my children, in a fortunate sense, this may be one of the benefits of having been involved in Watergate, will understand the moral and ethical implications of a person's acts better than I possibly did.
Mr. Magruder, can you tell us some of the ways you were treated in prison? It's been said that the Watergate, the people in the Watergate scandal were treated well by other inmates. Is that true?
Well, treated well by other inmates.
Yes.
I found the inmates to be human beings who were kind and good, and some possibly not so good, and you found out who were the type of people who you could deal with, and that's what I did at Allenwood, and I had no trouble at Allenwood with any of the inmates, and I think that the experience of Chuck and John Deans and Herb Kalmbach was basically the same. We found that we were dealing with human beings.
Can you tell us how the human beings and how you yourself reacted to the pardon, the Nixon pardon?
Well, I think that the penalties the former president had paid, and my feelings were sufficient, and that to have him go through the judicial process would have been very, very difficult, and I think his illness would indicate that it would have been, I think, an extremely traumatic experience for him, and I am very pleased that President Ford pardoned him.
Mr. Magruder, would you advise, if you were ever asked, Mr. Nixon, Mr. Haldeman, Mr. Ehrlichman, Mr. Mitchell, any who are still, in effect, stonewalling it, would you advise them to admit whatever role they played in the scandal and get it out?
Well, the thing that made all the difference for me was admitting it. I think I was forgiven. I was forgiven by my
whom?
Family. I was forgiven by God, I think, which was to me the most important forgiveness I needed. And and the guilt feelings I had over Watergate and of the effect it had on my family, which was a terrible feeling of guilt that I had, I think have been washed away over the months because I did come forward. And I think anyone who makes a mistake always feels better when he's able to get it out and deal with it rather than keeping it within himself.
Would you anticipate that any of these people would do that?
I think you'd have to ask them. Up to this point, they have not. I think it's an individual decision each person has to make.
Let me go back and ask you a more simple, factual question, perhaps. Why Larry O'Brien's office?
Well, that's a good question. I've often wondered that now, too.
Who decided?
I think the fact it was basically agreed by Mr. Mitchell that his was the most appropriate office at that time, simply because he was the most effective spokesman and we thought was going to be the basic political manager of the candidate's campaign.
You're aware of all the talk about the Hughes money, the
yes.
Rebozo involvement, and so
yes.
forth. Was there any of that involved that you knew of? First or second hand?
No, I did not know. Only the news reports that I have read, which seem to have some, make some sense to me. I can see that, unbeknownst to me, there may have been interest in finding some things out that would have involved Mr. Hughes and Mr. O'Brien.
Why do you think Judge Sirica released you?
I really don't know, of course. I was very just pleased with his comments, which seemed to me to indicate that he realized that in our cases we had paid a tremendous penalty. I think in the total context of Watergate, those who have been involved did pay a tremendous penalty because of the publicity, because of the continued emphasis of Watergate in the public's eye, that we paid the penalty of exposure to the press and to the public as well as the prison sentences. And I think he truly was compassionate to the situation that had developed with our families and felt that we had been penalized enough.
One of the things that you said in the book, and it was quoted in various articles and so forth, it seemed inconceivable to you all at the time that with all your political power, you could not erase the mistake that had been made, that the cover-up would not succeed. It didn't. What went wrong?
I think two things. I think the judge was extremely hard-driving about finding the truth and made it apparent to the initial seven that he was not going to let them off the hook until the truth came out. And then because of that, I think the co-conspirators, those of us who were in the conspiracy, saw the conspiracy collapse, had felt it was wrong from the beginning basically, and the reasons for continuing it, which was the president's reelection, were no longer valid. And I think most of us felt that we could not continue this conspiracy, and I think it collapsed of its own weight.
In the beginning, though, Mr. Magruder, what if the president had admitted the responsibility of his people immediately after the break-in, and then there would have been no cover-up? Was that ever even considered?
I guess it was not considered. I think, of course, in retrospect, if it had been done, Watergate would have never become an issue in this country.
Now that you've been in prison, Mr. Magruder, do you still agree with the strong law and order position that the Nixon administration took?
Not in the way it is interpreted by the public. I think that the prison system, and I think most of the prison authorities would agree with me, is no solution to the problems that occur in this country. Of the 300 crimes that are committed, only 100 are reported, only 10 are convicted, and only 3, I think, end up going to prison. I think those are basically the figures that have been quoted by most authorities. Consequently, the prison system is only the battered child of the crime problem in this country. I think it's 1 out of a 300, in effect, end up in prison, and that is not going to solve the problems of our society, and the prison system does not solve it, it makes it worse.
Let me ask you a question that troubles me out of what you say in your book. You talk about how when a senator or a politician took a stand that displeased you, you would organize a letter-writing campaign and have him deluged with letters.
Yes.
Can any politician now trust his mail? Should any politician pay attention to his mail since it's being manipulated by people like yourself?
Well, I certainly now, in retrospect, feel that that type of manipulation is part of our unethical structure and is not appropriate. And I think that has been done. It's been done historically, and I think I'm sure it's still being done. I think it's unfortunate.
Well, then, can a politician trust his mail, or should he pay no attention to it?
I think he should be very careful about what he reads in his mail, and usually you can tell what's being manipulated and what is honest, to straightforward opinion.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Magruder, for being with us today on Face the Nation.
When you're director of plant management in an operation like this, one of your jobs is to keep electric bills from going sky high. Well, you don't do that by just turning off a switch here and a switch there. You put a computer to work for you. So a few years back, we called in IBM and worked out a power management program with them. First, electrical equipment was wired into a computer. This gives us a minute-by-minute record of the electricity we use at every one of our stores. Through this data, we've learned to avoid wasteful surges of electrical power. Our heating and air conditioning systems, for example. Now, the computer regulates the fans, the big cooling units, the heating units, in a way that uses power more smoothly, more economically. Still, everyone's as comfortable as ever in here. Of course, some things can't do without a steady flow of power, so the computer compensates by turning off some of our less essential equipment, like pumps, water heaters, and things like that. The IBM Power Management Program is set up to save us money. We like that idea, but we also like the idea that Riches is now helping to conserve Atlanta's electrical power.
IBM, helping people find the answers.
Today on Face the Nation, Jeb Stuart Magruder, former deputy director of the Nixon Re-Election Committee, who has just been released from prison, was interviewed by CBS News correspondent Leslie Stahl, Hayes Gorey of Time Magazine, and CBS News correspondent George Herman. Face the Nation has been sponsored by IBM. Next week, another prominent figure in the news will face the nation. This broadcast was produced by CBS News.